Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, and welcome to The Critic magazine's new podcast. Exciting new podcast, which is for those who, like us, enjoy the arts and would like to hear a little bit more intelligent, light-hearted, uncensored and informed conversation about them. I'm Robert Thickness. I'm a writer and music critic, and I cover opera for the amazing Critic magazine. And for the last 25 years, I've been doing the same sort of thing across many newspapers and magazines. I'm also current president of the Critic Circle, which is just as grand as it sounds, and this professional association of the United Kingdom's arts journalists and critics. With me to discuss whatever comes our way, I have two old friends and colleagues. First, Lucy Lethbridge, who is author of The Social Histories, Servants and Tourists, former literary editor of The Tablet, and a writer of art and television reviews. Hello, Lucy.
Hello.
And also, Yehuda Shapiro. Yehuda specialises in opera, like me, bringing a much wider cultural range of interests and knowledge to our little niche. Yehuda mostly writes for Opera Magazine, and he contributes reviews and features to The Stage. Now, each time we do this podcast, we're planning to invite guests, and which are going to be people involved with current happenings in the arts world, and interested observers. And today, we are delighted to have with us Elena Langer, who is the genre-busting composer. I nearly said gender-busting composer. Are you a gender-busting composer?
Absolutely not.
The genre-busting composer of hits for Welsh National Opera, such as the opera Figaro Gets a Divorce and the vaudeville Rhonda Rips It Up. Are you genre-busting?
Well, I like writing, hopefully, fun things and contrasting things.
Maybe you don't believe in genre.
I like opera.
What about vaudeville? Do you like vaudeville?
Vaudeville is fine.
Okay. She wrote a vaudeville called Rhonda Rips It Up. And last year wrote a very entertaining big cantata for London Philharmonic Orchestra based on Edward Lear's poem, The Dong with a Luminous Nose. Later on, we'll be joined by the theatre and opera director, Joe Hill Gibbons, whose hits include Ibsen's Ghosts at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse last year and the tragedy of King Richard II at the Almeida, and whose staging of Béla Bartók's short 1918 opera Duke Bluebeard's Castle is appearing at ENO in March. Now, why are we doing this? We're doing it because it's basically the sort of thing that we want to hear, and we feel that we don't hear enough of it. Would you agree with me about that, Yehuda?
Maybe in some respects one hears too much of it, but I think I think part of where this comes from is that we don't want to always be on side, as it were, with the world of the arts, because the world of the arts sometimes behaves as if it's got its back against the wall and everyone feels they have to show a united front. But there needs to be a space for constructive criticism and informed criticism, and it's not just a question of sort of sounding off and blowing one's own critical trumpet. It's actually acting as a proxy for people who are interested in the arts, I think.
And I feel that there's the kind of proper discussion of the arts is vanishing. That there's much less space, obviously, in print media, but also in broadcast media. What you mostly get is some kind of PR under another guise, with a lot of, you hear a lot of stuff from kind of fan blogs and influencers and the arts themselves telling us on social media how amazing they are, with no kind of objective criticism. Do you find this, Lucy? Do you find this is a narrowing field that we live in?
Well, a little bit, yes. And I think that because so many of the arts now take this slightly hectoring air, as if they're in the, you know, they wear their educational purpose very heavily, I think that it becomes very difficult to properly look at them objectively because one has to be on one side or the other. One's made to feel that in some way that there is a correct response, and there shouldn't be a correct response ever.
is, I mean, that is an interesting point, because the arts can present themselves as being sort of beleaguered and under pressure from people like the Arts Council, who obviously have a mission to destroy everything. I mean, we understand that. But you know, to some extent, the arts themselves seem to have gone to extreme lengths to make themselves kind of obnoxious to their traditional public in exactly those kind of ways. In the way that they've turned into, they've become kind of social engineers of some sort. There are agendas everywhere. So it happens everywhere, from museums removing exhibits and galleries putting up ridiculous captions written by kind of pre-literate teenagers telling us what to think, and theatres tying themselves in idiotic knots over casting and trigger warnings everywhere, while forgetting things that are actually important. And you were talking to me about this, Elena, about what you find in the classical music world and the radio and so forth. Is something like that happening as well?
Yes, I think so. I'm quite objective and looking at everything from a distance of the way. I arrived to this country 24 years ago, and I didn't speak good English, but I was listening to Radio 3 all the time, and I was absolutely... I was so impressed by the quality, by the intellectual quality of some of the programs. And I used to call my friends in Russia and I said, listen, why did we even go to this Gnesin College of Music or to the conservatory? You can switch on the radio here and you listen and you know everything you want to know about the music. And then now when I switch it on, I have to switch it off because it's kind of flirting with, I'm not sure who is directed at, because it stopped being interesting to me and to people like me. And at the same time, it's not appealing to my son, who is 18 years old, and he is like in between. It has no rigor, but there are still some good programs like Compose of the Week, which educate you and play lots of music and give facts. But it's what annoys me is this flirtation with and simplifying, kind of not thinking highly of your audience.
I think there's some sense going around that enjoying something and understanding it and being critical about it, they're mutually exclusive. And I think that's quite a destructive approach, because you can enjoy something and still be critical about it. And still critical in the broad sense, not critical in the negative sense of saying, I don't like it. It's a critical act that you can apply thinking to it. And that seems to be something that people are a little wary of. And equally, if something's purely entertaining, it's not worthy of talking about, which it can be. I mean, you look at the old movies from the 30s, and they were highly entertaining and highly commercial and highly contrived, and they're, in a way, they're masterpieces. So,
yes, I wonder if we've become simultaneously much, much more serious and much more ponderous. And also much sort of much more simple and much easier, and everything is rather dumbed down. I think, you know, dumbed down and serious seems
to
be...
Yes, the worst combination.
Is the worst.
but I think dumbing down's fine as long as you've got some hinterland that you can put behind it.
Yeah.
I don't think that dumbing down is fine. It's absolutely not fine. You can't dilute. There is no point in diluting classical radio with all kinds of other music, which there are other radio stations and people have interest in them. It's just the audience seems unclear. The quality of the audience that they're aiming at seems
unclear. But I think it's a question of the remit of the medium as well. It's a bit like, we're going to be talking about ENO later. I'm not quite sure what ENO's remit is, and I haven't been for a long time. And I think it's awful that it's been under such pressure. But if I understood better what it's really meant to be about, apart from singing in English, I would feel it had a stronger argument to make.
So, as you can tell, we're like enormous fans, very positive about everything. But actually, we feel all those things very deeply and correctly. But it's also important to say that we don't just hate everything. We are great fans of all these things, and we just want it to be done better, if at all possible. Anyway, so all of that stuff, that ends now. This is the antidote to all of that, right?
I don't think it's a question of it being done. It's not done better. It's about being true to what it is.
Being true to the quality of things, and then when quality should be the
there's
of course absolutely, and we you know, London is still the cultural centre of the world, and we know that, and we're immensely grateful for it, and but and we're going to celebrate that, but we're also going to complain about it when necessary because we're critics, who of course are the at least three of us. Would you call yourself a critic, Lucy? You're a bit of a critic.
I am a critic.
So three of us are critics, at least, and therefore the most popular people in the world. You're generally supposed to be kind of parasites and nitpickers and snobs and worms and perverts and parasites. But they only say that when we're not giving them awards, I find. When we're giving them awards, they're very nice to us. Len, have you had run-ins with critics? How has it been with you, with the whole critical fraternity?
Well, I like critics because they know things, and it's interesting to talk to critics. Sometimes it's less interesting to read what what some of them write. On the way here, I was reading Cesar Cui's little book. He is one of the Mighty Five composers, but probably the least talented one. And he was a critic as well, or the critic. And he wrote reviews, and he was so honest and to himself and to the audience. And he wrote, I heard a concert tonight, and it was neither bad nor good. And I wish they invited Berlioz to conduct, because Berlioz is the best conductor these days, and he understands the music. So it's...
It would have been a long trip for Berlioz to come
all the
way from Paris.
No, all the way from Paris. They came to Petersburg in those days, and Wagner came to conduct, and he compared Wagner's conducting to Berlioz conducting to other Russian conductors. He wrote about Clara Schumann performing in Petersburg, how popular she was, and it's fun to read.
So, as your main thing is that you're agreeing with us that basically critics should be not regarded as all those unpleasant things, but basically as public servants, since we're guardians of most people's most important possession, which is their leisure time, and we should probably have a bit more respect. Would you agree with that?
I think so. Yes, yes. Taste.
So that's the preamble. And it's time to come clean about this podcast that everyone is hoping is going to deal with popular art forms, and it will in due course. But today I'm afraid that we're going in at the deep end with opera. But don't panic and don't go away, because it's a very nice and short opera and one of the highlights of the early 20th century. But The Tale of Bluebeard is rather more than opera. Because the story, of course, goes across books and films and theatre and raises a large number of quite interesting questions. Bluebeard's Castle by Béla Bartók is coming up in March for a couple of performances at English National Opera, and is still an icon of modernism and how that early 20th century attempt to reinvent opera after Wagner, which was amazing and then kind of fizzled out, in a sort of way. And in a while, we're going to be talking to the director, Joe Hill Gibbons, about that, who mostly operates in straight theatre, but has had quite a lot of success in his forays over the fence into opera. And by contrast, there's a new theatre piece also called Blue Beard, created by Emma Rice, currently touring the country, which is completely different. And we're also going to have a little chat about. But before we get to that, we thought it would be nice to come up with some little vignettes and morsels from the world of the arts to cheer us all up in the way of entertainment. And so I have a few little things in the way of some recent trigger warnings, which we picked up, which I hope will be of value to the listeners. One of my favourites was, there was a Young Vic production of a play called Further Than the Furthest Thing, where audiences were warned that the show involves the handling of cooked egg. And when I was reading this, it occurred to me that perhaps there should be another category of things that they haven't mentioned in the trigger warnings, but they should have. So in this one, for example, you might say that the actors should be warned about the possibility of raw eggs being thrown at them. This kind of thing. The Globe has given the upcoming Antony and Cleopatra in the summer
a warning for misogynoir, which...
Is that like Scandi noir?
It's not like Scandi noir. I was wondering if anybody knew what it was. I mean, but it certainly sounds posh, doesn't it, with the whole noir thing? No, it's racism and misogyny combined. The reason being that it's going to deal with issues of race, not because Shakespeare does, but because the actress who's going to be playing Cleopatra is non-white, Indian. But I'm kind of interested by the word and whether this should be. And it seems to me that if you're going to do Antony and Cleopatra, you should at least like talk about settler colonialism and stuff like this, you know, stuff which is really du jour, rather than inventing her. It's all there, isn't it? All those Greeks ruling Egypt.
It just seems to me that they're inventing a word that a lot of people aren't going to necessarily understand immediately, which is, it seems to be
perhaps they'll educate defeating them. Its purpose. They'll educate them in it, and they will understand by... Also, in the summer we've got, or in the spring we've got coming up at the Royal College of Music, there's playing the operetta The Merry Widow by Franz Lehár, and in this... You should be warned that there are scenes of smoking. And, I mean, you know, again, since Merry Widow mostly takes place in a kind of cat house in Paris, I feel that we should be warned against the exploitation of women and all kinds of things like that.
They're not coaxes, Maxime's, are they?
There probably are, you heard. I mean, I think you're the expert on that area.
Flames,
you see? Yeah,
but
local council will be on them.
To go with the smoke, you know, smoke without fire, as they say, so there must be.
But every period film now signals its you know, age by having people chain smoking to such an extent you wonder that they're still upright. You know, from Mad Men onwards, Maestro had Leonard Bernstein smoking about 80 a day.
I think he
but did. Not in a good way, right? Was it in a kind of monetary way, admonitory?
Well, I think it probably was, but it's an indication, isn't it? It's rather like putting someone in a crinoline and saying, now we are in the Victorian times. If someone is smoking or, you know, drinking in the morning or something,
Mad Men was entirely exactly. That, wasn't it? Look at these...
Reprehensible.
Really dreadful people.
Well, the notorious prosthetic nose wasn't at risk of melting.
It must have been very uncomfortable. It must have got very hot.
I mean, you're being very reticent here with your, but I very much enjoyed the one that Yehuda came up with recently, which was a production of Chekhov's Seagull, which came with these following beware of warnings. Seagull contains suicide, mental illness, animal death, and a gunshot. So now you don't need to see the bloody play, do you? Because we've done it.
That's the plot.
That is the plot. Any offerings in this area?
Well, I quite like tuning into Radio 4 Extra sometimes, and you get these things like the Navy Lark. Shocking. And the Goons, and they always have to be prefaced with this little thing. There are attitudes that were of the time, and listeners may find disturbing. So you get, I don't know, it's usually... Leslie Phillips saying ding dong or something like that, but it does seem, and you can't imagine there's anyone who's actually tuned into Radio 4 Extra who's going to turn off in fear and trembling that they're, you know, they've got naughty vicar. Yeah, phew. Oh yes.
His wife, who's actually very smart, is constantly packed by the go, you don't want to drive, do you, Steve?
Steve. Well done, Steve.
I mean, it does raise the question of what on earth these things are for. I mean, has anybody ever read a trigger warning and said, I'm not going to go to that?
The only thing I would say is that it's quite good for people like us who grew up not questioning these things, because it does, at least it does make you think about it, which I think is quite a positive thing in a way. And if, for instance, The Merry Widow, which is a piece that's seen as a piece of fluff, but it has sort of interesting themes running through it, if it stops people from directing the operas if it's a complete piece of fluff, or the operettas if it's a piece of fluff, then that's something good that will come out.
But you're saying that they need to actually spell out all the interesting things, we're going to do with Blue Hair.
I mean, I don't think so, but just if
in a way, it's quite good to be pulled up and have your preconceptions challenged a little bit, even if you don't necessarily agree with what's being done.
Yes, right. I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what are the trigger warnings for today? Are we going to have like eye gouging in our discussion of, or is it just going to be more kind of psychological torture, do you think?
I think Bluebeard is torture all the way through, isn't it? It on every single level, and marvellously so.
And, I mean, the thing is that I kind of get the impression these days that opera is sort of about the last place that all these dodgy things can really be aired, partly because it takes place in foreign language and therefore nobody knows what's going on, or you know, the great censorious powers have not got hold of it yet. So, you know, all the kind of obsession with deformity and disease and mental weirdness in Wagner, this kind of thing. If it was on telly, it would have been banned ages ago. But we can kind of get away with it. So this is why Bluebeard is a very fruitful topic of conversation. Shall we move on to it?
I mean, before we get to the opera, let's think about the story. I mean, it appears, Yehuda, that you're here the expert, with our French literature expert. It appears first in Charles Perrault.
I haven't done my background research completely on that, because presumably he drew on some other sources before.
There's a suggestion that he made it up.
Right.
That's the thing I hear. But you know, obviously there have been kind of sources posited, like Gilles de Rais is always brought up.
Yes.
Although Gilles de Rais, really, I mean, it has literally nothing in common with this, except that he killed lots of people.
He killed children.
He killed children mostly, yeah, exactly. Or I think exclusively. So it's not really, it doesn't fit very well, but there's that kind of thing. But if Perrault made this up, I mean, one wonders what exactly he's driving at. But in any case, one wonders what the story is driving at. What is the story driving at?
I don't think the story's driving at anything, to tell the truth. I mean, it's actually very modern. It's just almost like an artifact with this quite sort of abstract, detached story. I mean, the thing that struck me very much the first time I read it, and strikes me every time I read it, is the fact that when he tells us that the bodies of the wives are hanging there, it's put in brackets. It's almost like an aside that there are all these dead bodies hanging there. And I think that's a sort of brilliant, the sort of thing you'd expect a 20th century author to do. You know, it's a sort of postmodern approach almost to it.
And why
do you... Fascinating.
And do you think that was because, in a sort of way, rather like with fairy tales, sometimes the details that we look for, because we're used to reading stories as novels or as complicated examinations, fairy tales sometimes put those sort of details in brackets because they are subsidiary to the kind of driving nature of the fable.
I think maybe that's the case. Because they're these sequences of events, aren't they, fairy stories?
Yes.
They move, it's like a comic strip, moving from one frame to the next, and they're not necessarily joined up.
Yeah, so he's not, so in a sense, the finding of the body, he's not writing a narrative. You know, he's not thinking about ways in which
like
he can make the narrative sort of sing. You know, the narrative just comes with these little elements that are tied together.
Yeah. All the stories are written in this slightly detached way, and you never know whether the moralising is tongue in cheek or not.
It certainly sounds.
Yeah.
I mean, when he sticks a couple of morals on the end of Bluebeard, saying one, they don't like make husbands like that anymore.
They don't make husbands like that
anymore. They don't make husbands like that anymore. And number two, curiosity is a dangerous thing, so it is. which I mean, of course, both literally true, but
also the first one could be a joke, couldn't it?
I think they're both jokes. It's like he's written a story and possibly even made it up as a joke, and then stuck a joke moral on it, or two joke morals on the end of it. So it's quite peculiar. But anyway, so it is what it is.
And the other interesting thing about it doesn't have any supernatural elements in it, apart from the blood on the key, which won't come off.
That's a bit supernatural.
But apart from that, it's not really supernatural, which is interesting for a soi-disant fairy story.
And there's no... although unlikely things happen, I guess, but it's not quite the same as supernatural, right?
No, I mean, there are no fairies and
Okay, no goblins. Puss in boots. Elves. Right. Okay.
But there are tasks, aren't there? Is it a task to open the... I mean, that's very typical of fairy stories, isn't it? The seven doors, you know, lots of fairy stories have those sort of tasks by which you have to open seven doors and you encounter seven dogs and, you know, and you go further into the story through that.
So that's in the opera, though. I don't think it's in the story.
Oh, okay.
What is in the story is that he gives her all the keys. I mean, it's not like he says, you know, it's not like she finds a door that says do not open on it. He gives her the key to open on it, to open the door. I was clearly intending her to open it.
I think it's a bit like Alice in Wonderland as well.
Right, I mean, or Alice in Wonderland clearly must draw on it, yeah. So it seems to me that the big thing that arises out of it is this nature, this kind of fabulous idea of doing the one thing which is forbidden, right? I mean, so, and which involves Kidrasti. It's often attributed to women, and that's in the story of Eve and Semele and, you know, I don't know, Elsa and Lohengrin. Now I'm very pleased to say we're joined by, as I mentioned earlier, the director, Joe Hill Gibbons. And Joe, welcome.
Thank you.
You're going to be directing Bluebeard at English National Opera, which is... we don't get to see Bluebeard very, very often, so yeah. we're always very excited when it turns up.
Yeah.
It's always kind of nice for us when you haven't done that much opera. You've done. I remember I saw you did Powder Her Face a few years ago.
Yeah, I think this semi-stage version of Bluebeard at English National Opera will be number five. I think for me, I started in theatre, so that's where my background is really. But
I mean, that's it, because we all get terribly excited when a director from straight theatre comes over the fence to us, because there tends to be this division, right? I mean, it's because of the various different timescales of theatre and opera, and it's difficult to kind of have a career in both, but people then seem to specialise in one or the other. And we're kind of excited because, you know, opera people can get very hung up on the conventions of opera, and you came through kind of new ones like Powder Her Face, Tom Addis' thing, and Greek, the Turnage thing that you staged, which are obviously kind of free of quite a lot of operatic conventions, but then you were pitched into Figaro, Marriage of Figaro at ENO. And I loved it. I thought it was absolutely, I really thought it was great and so fresh and powerful. And it's like, oh my God, he's got it. You know, like I was very Henry Higgins about it. But was that terrifying to be kind of pitched into something that everybody has expectations of?
Actually, being, as you say, new to opera makes it way less terrifying. Like, for example, I directed A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Young Vic, and I loved that play, and I really enjoyed that production. But, you know, if you're a theatre person like I am, of course you've seen A Midsummer Night's Dream, like, 200 times. So, you know, working with that Shakespeare text, I was so aware of, like, all the different versions that have gone before. And being a real ignoramus when it comes to opera, the truth is, I didn't know Figaro. They said, do you want to do The Marriage of Figaro? It's like, yeah, I've heard of that one. That's one of the bangers. I'd love to do it. But I knew, shockingly, like nothing about it. And so it was all fresh for me. And when you're coming in from the outside, you don't know what the cliches are. You don't know what's been done before. And in a way, that's kind of freeing. That makes it less intimidating.
During the process, did you kind of get the impression? Did anyone come and say you can't do that? That's not the way we do it. Or were you really?
A lot of people. It's interesting with Figaro because people love it, right? It's absolutely people's favourite opera. But often I would go round to people and I would say, because obviously I was desperate to find out. I was saying, that's great. You know, what are the best productions? What's your favourite production of Figaro? And often people would go, well, I think it's quite hard, you know. And I think if I knew how hard it was when I started, I would have been terrified. It took a long... It's a brilliant piece, but it's really tricky. It's one of the hardest things I've ever designed. You know, we ended up coming up with this really simple idea, which was this white room with four doors in it and nothing else. But that took ages for me and Johanna Schütz, to the German designer, to get to that place. So it's a brilliant piece, and it's a popular piece, but it's really challenging.
It is tough. I mean, and it's a graveyard for lots of directors, but often for kind of like first timers, I think you just look great. And the way you use those doors, I just thought it was fantastic. The door would fly open, and you would see a very kind of revealing tableau, physical tableau revealing, you know, psychological states. Mm-hmm. And so, and which is, you know, because it's, I don't know if you knew the Beaumarchais play. You must have read the Beaumarchais
play. I did read the Beaumarchais play.
It's completely different from the Beaumarchais play, even though the words are basically the same.
It's completely different.
How different it is.
And, I mean, I don't know whether this is heretical to say it, but I think the Beaumarchais play is not very good.
Well, it's a kind of sex, it's a little French sex comedy.
It's
right?
Quite crap, and so that's why Figaro has this strange quality of this kind of, it's like some weird kind of alchemy, because you have the kind of base metal of the Beaumarchais, and then of course you have this complete genius of Mozart. But that gives it a funny quality, because when you're working on it, you're simultaneously thinking, this is incredible, and thinking, bits of this are quite crap, you know. There's elements in here which are quite hard to manage. But, you know, at the end of the day, the music's incredible in that.
Well, you're right, I mean, like, because dramatically, and how do you deal with it? Nobody can tell you the story of how many letters there are, and who's, you know. Nobody knows. But the thing, it just doesn't matter. It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, you know, so the way that Mozart, and, like, this is how opera works, right? The way that Mozart makes it different from Beaumarchais is through music. Now, I mean, what was your collision with music like? I mean, because a lot of theatre directors feel very frustrated by the way that the music dictates the pace, and it kind of takes away your freedom. And what does it mean? Is this just a play with music, or is something else happening? But clearly you realised that something else was happening.
I really like moving back and forth between theatre and opera. And I think everything being dictated by the music, you know, whether that be the rhythm, the tempo, the emotional highs and lows of the piece, that's actually great, you know, coming from theatre, because operas are these incredible kind of music machines, you know, which are literally conducted by someone else, it's not me. You know, when you make a theatre show and you have to develop it through previews, you have the preview where it's too slow, and then the preview where it's too fast, and then the preview where it's too loud, and, you know, because the actors have to feel their way into it and work out how to sort of build it together every night. You don't have that with opera. You know, you have this incredible orchestral machine which just gives you so much. And so in that respect, it kind of makes it slightly easier that the music gives so much to you that in theatre you have to kind of build organically every night.
Do you think there's a danger that the music dictates too much to you as a director? Do you feel you're being dictated to by the music, or how do you maintain your freedom, as it were?
I don't feel sort of pushed around by it, you know. I mean, you know, and you always have the option of sort of really going with the music, you know, even Mickey Mousing it, and, like, you know, thinking, well, how do we create something on stage for every inflection of the music? Or you can go against it. You know, if you have a very frenetic piece of music, you can stage it something in a very static way. You know, it's a real gift. I mean, the truth is, when you first encounter an opera, there will be periods of music in the middle of scenes where you're thinking, that's quite a long bit of music. What am I going to do with that 1 minute of music, which is just in the middle of this scene? But of course, you have to think your way into it. You have to think about what's going on between the characters, what's going on psychologically, emotionally, and the more you work on it, the more you think, okay, I really understand what's going on here.
You have to wait till you're doing Handel operas.
Yeah.
Then you've got like 15 minutes of one person on stage.
Saying one line again and again.
And, you know, usually people resort to having kind of tea-making equipment brought on, make yourself very slowly, make yourself a cup of tea and all this kind of stuff, you know, goes and has a sit-down, gets up, walks over here. But that's the test. That's
yeah.
the one.
I look forward to that, yeah.
Brilliant. Should we then get back to Bluebeard, and get on to Bluebeard that we want to talk about? So we vaguely discussed the fairy story, the folk story,
yeah.
And what's kind of coming out of it. And like, it seems to me that the one of the headline things is the, you know, the matter of being forbidden to do something and then going to do it. Mm. I mean, this is obviously big throughout mythology and and art in every way, from Eve and Semele onwards to is, although, I mean, it's in the original story that the there's this added thing that he gives her the key. It isn't. It's not like it doesn't. It's not a door which has no entry.
Yeah,
decides to smash away down. There's this. It's rather like the snake and the apple, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly like that. Yeah.
But it's not like that in the opera. But the things arising from it, we were going to talk about those. Lucy, tell us more about the issues in Bluebeard.
Well, I mean, what struck me looking at the Michael Powell Bluebeard was that
this is the film, so the re-released film of that Michael Powell made of Bluebeard the opera in about 63
for German television.
German television, and has vanished and was recently brought out and can be seen on things like Amazon and BFI Player, and is amazing. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it yet. Yeah,
go and see it. Yeah. It really is not too bad.
Well, it just struck me. I mean, I don't know what you would think of this. Is that in this period, this sort of mid 20th century period, when everyone is very interested in psychoanalysis, this idea of Bluebeard being being a subject for analysis, you know, that she is trying to pull out these keys to get these gates, and the last gate he can't give her, and then when he does, he's so exposed that she has to die. I mean, I thought that felt to me like a kind of deep Jungian penetration of analysis. And I wondered if that would, you know, if that was something that had occurred to you.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you can't help but see these, you know, well, you can read these incredible mythic stories in like 100 different ways, but I mean, I would tend to gravitate more towards the psychological and the psychosexual and, you know, as a story about a relationship between men and women, or as a story about, you know, intimate relationships. I think it's pretty incredible and psychologically very rich, you know, this idea. Have any of you seen the Pina Bausch version? Pina Bausch, the German choreographer and director, she made an incredible version of it, which is with her dance company, which is danced to the music of Bartok. And that was incredibly revealing to me in terms of what the piece says about men and women, you know, because you really got this sense of people inside relationships that are kind of desperate and trapped, you know, in the Pina Bausch, but also in the Bartok piece, you know, the new wife, Judith, desperately, desperately wants to know her new husband. She wants to know every aspect of him. She wants him to reveal his private secret self, you know, partly because she loves him. I mean, that's what's interesting. That's what really came across, actually, more than in like the fairy story, but in the Pina Bausch and in the Bartok, is that she does love him, at least in the Bartok. She says again and again, yeah, yeah. And so she's trapped in this desire to know him and be intimate with him. And then on the side of Bluebeard, in the Pina Bausch dance piece, the Bluebeard figure was sort of hunched over a tape recorder, repeatedly playing and replaying bits of the Bartok. And you had a sense of men as being somehow trapped in strange obsessions, unable to kind of reach out and expose themselves or show themselves to their partners, you know. And in a way, this sense of it being really about a relationship between two people, which is not so much in the fairy story, actually. You don't really think about it being about the relationship. In a way, the critical part of the story happens when Bluebeard goes away, right? That's the most interesting part of the story, is when she's going through the doors when he's not there. But, you know, in the Pina Bausch one, like in the Bartok one, Bluebeard's there the whole time. Bluebeard doesn't go away in the Bartok piece, does he? So it's a completely, the whole thing is a interaction between two people the whole time, like an intense kind of conversation, you know, a kind of long dark night of the soul kind of late night conversation between a couple that goes on and on until dawn.
I mean, you get the impression that like Bartok was on Bluebeard's side. I mean, I think he was quite a kind of closed up and defensive guy. I mean, but this is, it is two different approaches to a relationship, right? I mean, tell me everything or I'll keep my secret, thank you very much. Which is, I mean, now it's very, very popular. The former is very popular, I believe. Is that right? The you know, everyone must know everything. Is that, this is the modern way, right? Whereas the old fashioned way is nobody ever told anybody anything, and this is what Bluebeard is kind of into. But there's this kind of primeval fear of people knowing things. And originally, so like in the Lohengrin story, you know, it's his name that he won't let her know. Don't ask my name. Mm-hmm. Because giving someone if somebody knows your name, they have power over you, and also they can take it away and do like voodoo and put hexes on you and this kind of thing.
And women are often frighteningly garrulous, aren't they, in these old sort of mythic stories? They're terrifyingly free with secrets. You know, there are all sorts of medieval poems where you tell a woman something and she goes and she rushes off and tells everyone else. There's a sort of, you know, they're loose rather than contained.
But am I right in thinking he doesn't actually forbid her anything in the opera, does he? He's reluctant to open the doors, but he doesn't forbid her anything, and isn't that a major difference, isn't it?
He keeps warning her.
Yes.
He keeps saying, "Are you sure yes. about this? Be careful. This is dangerous." But no, ultimately he doesn't forbid her anything. And, you know, I mean, yeah, in many senses, you can listen to it and think, well, you know, in such a gendered story, Bartok being a man kind of sees it from Bluebeard's point of view. But at the same time, you know, listening to it, I was working on it this morning, it's actually amazing how active Judith is.
Which is feisty.
You know, it's really her story. You know, she's the one who's driving it. She's the one, certainly in the first half of the piece, sings way more than him. I mean, she's the one who's driving the story forward.
And doesn't she leave her family for him? I mean, at the beginning she says, "I've given it all up for you," doesn't she? So she's not a shrinking violinist at all.
No, I think she's. I think she's basically run away to him. Unlike in the Perrault story, she's just a kind of gold digger.
Yes, yes.
But here, Judith is. I mean, it's a bit. But then there's this the kind of echoed musically, and the music and the drum are both going this kind of urge, and there's a sort of power struggle, isn't there? And halfway, it's, you know, when he opens the big door and everything goes into C major and all the big chords, then that's sort of when the power struggle changes hands and everything becomes a bit grim. I mean, it's like up to that point, he was being okay with this kind of coaxing, this psychoanalysis, but then the shutters come down a bit after that. Yeah. But then he kind of he goes all sort of triumphant and says, "Aha, you will never know my secrets."
I always feel like she should quit while she's ahead at that point.
Just to take the garden and the jewels.
Take the lands. It's like a quiz show. It's like, I've opened door 5, and I'm going to stick with door 5. I'm not going to gamble.
Don't need the lake of tears.
The thing I was aware of when I was watching the film the other night, I mean, the music is so sad. The whole thing breaks my heart. Every time I hear it, it breaks my heart. And I don't know whether that's just my response to it or the sadness. It's right from the beginning, even when it's even when they're the celebratory bit. You know, you can think, oh God, it's going to get worse from here.
Yeah, it's definitely, it has a kind of majorly tragic kind of melancholic quality. I mean, it's, you know, it's about a marriage. It's about, we think, a loving relationship, which, you know, is you know, that kind of relationship is the greatest thing really you can experience in life. But this gives a kind of tragic tragic twist on it, doesn't it? Which, I mean, I guess it's something about what we were saying about, like, as you were saying, how much do you want to know about someone? You know, when you fall in love with someone, you just want more of them. You want to know more. You want to know everything about them. You want to spend more and more time with them. But I guess at some point, you get to a point where you know too much. They become too familiar, or they become not mysterious anymore, or they become everyday. So it definitely has a kind of tragic reflection on love.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember a bit where he says when she's about to die or to be grouped with the rest of the wives, he says that the memory of a person is almost better than the person. So it's a reflection. It's so about inner struggle and maybe he's trying to understand what love is, Bartok.
Yes. Yeah.
His librettist was saying that Bartok was a small, tiny man, and he was plenik. I forget the English
prison. Word.
The prison of his talent.
Yeah.
He.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of tragic.
But this is the
love. Yes.
The danger of knowing too much. If you know too much, then you find out things, you know, that are better to have a bit of mystery and a bit of fantasy about, even about the people you love. Don't you think? Leno, how do you think that this, it's like musically, how does he do it? I mean, so Yehuda was saying it's kind of sad, and it's a bit like Pelléas and Mélisande, which is also a bit sad by Debussy. And there's got quite a lot in common between this and Pelléas and Mélisande, except that he's taken Pelléas and Mélisande, which was written, I don't know, 10, 15 years before, and then added this kind of Hungarian folk music to it, or mixed it, put an Imagine mix with Hungarian folk music. How does it work? What's going on?
Yes,
here?
So he was. It's a known fact that he collected folk material. He and Kodály, they went to little villages and collected, and he couldn't stop. And again, Kodály writes that everyone is already wants to have a drink and lie down, and Bartok would still be recording these old people singing and then transcribing. And Kodály and Bartok, they invented the whole thing. I mean, when I studied at the Tchaikovsky Conservatory, it was part of the curriculum for composers to go and collect folk material. They invented it. It didn't exist before. Mm. So, and he takes this folk material, and it's not just intonations or bits of songs or rhythms. I think it extends to folklore as a ritual, and it frees a composer up completely, because he's not a prisoner of 12-tone system, which Schoenberg came up with. He just does completely something different and fresh, and which belongs to him, and opens up dramatic possibilities as well, because he doesn't have to do sonata form, he doesn't have to do any shapes from before, he doesn't have to follow any structures of the 20th century, so it's almost bottomless, fantastic spring from which composers can take and took, like Stravinsky, like so much. It's the whole thing of the probably to me it seems like the most fruitful 20th century musical development, when this raw material is taken and contemporary techniques are applied to it.
Have you done that? Is that part of your
Yes, I've done. I've done a loads of it, and other composers did. Like there is a French composer called Tristan Murail. He took Tuvinian singing. You know, Tuvinian, when they sing one note and then it brings overtones. So he used electronic equipment to prepare this Tuvinian singing and created the whole piece out of it. Composers do all kinds of things with it. And to me, it's the most interesting bit of the modernist music is when composers do this. I wrote a piece called Plach, which means lament, and because I was commissioned to write a string, a violin concerto, and I didn't see the reason to write as concerto, because Brahms wrote a concerto, Mendelssohn wrote a concerto. So you need to create your own reason for writing it. And when you use folk idiom, when there is theater involved. So at Russian folk weddings, the brides always cried, either the brides cried or they hired a professional lamenter who cried for them. So I imagine that the violin would be a professional lamenter who is hired to cry at the wedding, and the rest of the orchestra will be participants of this ritual. It's there's so many possibilities, theatrical and text and sensibility. So,
but I think the advantage in Bluebeard is that it feels very much of a piece, even though it's actually quite, you know, it's a set of episodes. It's because of the musical language. It feels very organic, and when you hear the semitones for the blood, it doesn't feel, oh look, big pointy finger, there's blood here. It grows out of the score. It's a bit shocking, but it's not like a Wagnerian leitmotif coming and telling you this is
yes,
what you
there
have
are,
to do
there
here.
Are no leitmotifs, and a fantastic thing is that we have tonal music, tonality like Mozart and all that, and we have Schoenberg atonal music. But in music, music is linear and theater is linear, so something needs to develop. We need some tension and release. And without tonal music, we don't have this tension and release in contemporary music.
No.
But by using folk tunes and the speech is so connected to the music. I think it's in Russian music, it's Mussorgsky who started mm-hmm. doing it, probably the most original composer of all the Russian composers. It's actually the speech. So he follows this Hungarian. When I was listening to it the other day, it's always this Hungarian rhythm, the first syllables. So somehow it helped him to create the feeling of tension and release without leitmotifs or without particular tonality.
But that whole tension and release.
So it's incredibly new.
But that whole tension and release, in Figaro, you know, the way in the last 5 minutes, the way when the Count begs for forgiveness. It's just every time it works, you know. It's that tension. That's an absolute classic example of the way it all builds to this moment, and suddenly everything stops,
and your heart stops as well, you know. And even though you don't really like the guy, you feel for him at that moment, don't you?
Yeah, I mean that moment of forgiveness in Figaro is a good example where the music is so good it's almost a problem, you know, partly because Mozart is trying to sort of wrap up the plot in this incredibly swift way at the end, which feels sort of very kind of, you know, clunky and contrived. And of course, as you say, it's really clear that the Count is a terrible, terrible guy. I mean, great character, but like awful person. And so of course he shouldn't be forgiven. And of course it goes against all our sort of contemporary kind of sexual politics, the belief that this guy should be given a second chance. He's awful. And then Mozart goes and writes this whatever it is, 25 seconds of the most beautiful music you've ever heard.
Which transfigures everything. And yeah. Because Mozart's business is to make you believe that it might possibly be true.
Mm, mm.
That then the world can be perfected through whatever it is that Mozart's bringing.
You yeah.
think
Bluebeard has a
second chance? Well, another wife coming.
Yeah, but how many wives? Yeah, he's on like a six or seven chance now, isn't it? How many wives do you have already? So yeah,
yeah. And they all got as far as the last door, presumably the wives. You know, and so that, I mean, you know, maybe he's improving as a subject. You know, a bit like therapy is a long-term process.
I think his therapist would say that he's stuck in the destructive, repetitive patterns in his relationships, I think.
Yeah. And he's desolate at the end, isn't he? I mean, so it's awful, you know.
Yeah, they're both kind of destroyed by it. It's the tragedy, isn't it? Yeah.
And he's bound on this wheel of fire, isn't he? He's got to go on and on. And you know that there'll be another and another and another and another until he drops dead.
Scheherazade was much more cunning.
Yeah.
in not giving all the information right away and withholding sex probably. Oh, night after night after night.
3 years to do
Yeah, so women have to get to be wily against these resistant sort of monolithic men who can't shake the pattern.
There are other ways of treating Bluebeard, and at the moment we've got this Emma Rice has created a theatre piece, which was on in Theatre Royal Bath, and is now touring. And we wanted to get to see it, but we didn't. And it looks kind of interesting, and you know, everyone says it's certainly not boring. And you know, one of Emma's very lively and varied and kind of heavily musical and exuberant pieces that at a certain point kind of cuts itself off and confronts you with a very unpleasant image. Mm-hmm. In this case, a kind of CCTV picture of a young woman walking home in the dark at night alone. I mean, Emma Rice's point about Bluebeard, she said it's the story is misogynist to its core, and she's gonna reclaim it, rescue the story for other purposes, which is, I mean, lots of people have taken the story of Bluebeard over the years and changed the ending and done what they wish. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I mean, is it misogynist, and can you rescue anything by changing the ending?
Yeah, have you read the Angela Carter, The Bloody Chamber?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fantastic version of it, where she really explores the kind of desire and eroticism of it brilliantly. But in the ending of that, it's her mother who comes and kills him. So it gives it this much more this kind of female-centric kind of feminist feeling to it, because instead of the brothers turning up and rescuing her, it's the mother who turns up on horseback and does away with Bluebeard.
It's a bit like the granny in Red Riding Hood, isn't it? Doesn't the granny rescue Red Riding Hood?
The granny is the wolf.
Granny's the wolf, sorry, yes. Maybe there's a version where granny rescues her.
The turnaround
version. No, I think it's the huntsman, I'm afraid, who rescues her.
Yes. This is a
well-designed
Red Riding Hood.
This happens, and I mean, people. There have been operas. There's another kind of simplest opera based on it by Duca, on the Maeterlinck play, and I mean, I don't really know what. I mean, this play by Béla Balázs, this Bluebeard, is also described as simplest. I don't really know what simplism. I think simplism is a bit of a kind of problematic literary form. The Russian writer Nikolai Gumilyov was once giving a lecture to the sailors at Kronstadt in about 1919 after the revolution, and he was explaining the different literary movements at the time, the acmeists, the supremacists, you know, everybody, and the rayonists, everything. And he said the problem with the symbolists was Alexander Bloch. His problem with them was that eventually they couldn't even sit down on a chair because the chair was a symbol of sexual insufficiency, or this neurosis. And this is the problem. I mean, what is symbolism?
Well, I think symbolism is more that it's suggesting as opposed to portraying. Or for Verlaine, for instance, it was about the sounds are part of the way his poems sound.
Les sons de
l'homme. Yeah, exactly. So I think it's the... And I was reading the old E&O Guide to Pelléas and Mélisande the other night. I'm that sad. I was reading that in bed, and you know, I was reading, and the libretto's in there, and it really is a very clever libretto because it feels very real, but it's not real. And I think that's what's interesting about it is it's this ambiguity, which I think is essential to Bluebeard, is what makes it interesting. And you know, there've been some recent productions where Bluebeard's been a psychopath or Judith's been an undercover agent, you know, by major directors in major houses. And you think, well, it's just not very interesting when you lose the ambiguity, is it? And the whole, you know, we've been talking for the last half hour and haven't come to a conclusion about it. And that, you know, if we're talking about critical processes, that's a damn sight more interesting than he's a baddie, she's a goodie. And that's as far as it goes.
I think it's one of the problems of the use of the word misogynist in this context, because it's so overused now, and it's so and it has a sort of overtone of something that can be cured or legislated against or kind of educated out of people. And I don't think, as you say, that ambiguity, you can't really, that's always at the heart of erotic relationships, it seems to me. You can't really kind of you can't educate that away. You can't moralise it away. I think it, you know...
It's a bit analogous to the way music works in an opera as well, because it suspends your critical faculties. When it's really good... When I saw Die Frau und das Schatten a couple of weeks ago, and there's all kinds of stuff in the libretto that people think is a bit unacceptable these days, you know, that basically women are there to have babies and that's how they realise their potential. And but the music is so totally glorious, I'd forgive it, I'd defy anybody to resist it. You know, and I didn't come out feeling guilty or dirty, I think some people might. Some people,
do you think?
Some people
I don't think Strauss maniacs are kind of impervious.
No, I'm very aware of Strauss's faults, but he doesn't
know.
No, does not pull it off.
You're in such kind of aesthetic heaven, after all that. But I think
it's not even aesthetic. It's just you're just overwhelmed. It's like being force-fed ice cream or something. Yeah,
there's no room for any other feelings. Yeah.
But I read the libretto of the Bluebeard, pretending that the music didn't exist, just to see how these words work. And there is, and the wonderfulness is somehow, there is this mystery and there is this rhythm and repetition, there is this almost hypnotic quality of the text. So it even made me feel like scared. So I can imagine that Bartok wanted to set this text. And it just, there is something happening between the words and the music. There is something in between which you can't explain.
But with the music, then he does. I mean, like Mozart, he adds something else, right? Because you can do things with music, like you can have them singing in like different keys, but also in different styles, which have a possibly subliminal effect on the listener, right? I mean, what does he do with it here?
There's so much color. He imposed. There is this text, and the text has its sway, and onto the sway he adds his rhythms and different keys and different colors, and it just becomes like.
But do you think there's something that's like a contrast in the way that in the music that they sing, which has some kind of psychological implication that might help us with what do you think, Jojo? You've listened to it. Do you think that they're singing different things, or are they singing at cross purposes in the way that they're talking at cross purposes, or in a different way, maybe?
I think tonally it's very mobile in a complex, interesting way. You know, on the one hand, it's often striking these notes of, as we were saying, kind of sorrow or fear or grief even, and then at the same time it has this drive to it that comes from desire and passion. You know, it is ultimately, it does, of course, feel very tragic, but it's propelled by a kind of, particularly by Judith's kind of vigorous force, that her desire to love, her desire to discover, her desire to know. And that comes across in the music as well, as much as it at times is very sweet and tender. At other times, it's extremely front foot and passionate.
But every bar of this music seems like about sex and death, every bar.
Yeah.
But there are there's one moment where it's almost become sort of archaic. He I can't remember, it's quite early on when it goes very sort of modal.
Medieval.
I think
it's the armory.
Yeah, he sings it.
It feels very sort of. But this is because it feels like film music, and particularly at that point, you think, "Oh my God, we're in a Robin Hood film, and we've gone into the Sheriff of Nottingham's armory, and that's exactly the music that Bernard Herrmann or Korngold or one of Max Steiner would have written, and because they're sort of reputed to have those guys who went usually from Austria, Hungary to America in the 20s and 30s. Kind of usually thought to have been, and in fact, in many cases, were the pupils of Richard Strauss. But actually, turns out the music's not really like, except when it gets very.
If you hear Miklos Rozsa, I know he's a bit later. I mean, it really sounds like Bartok.
It sounds like Bartok, doesn't it?
I really hear the Bernard Herrmann.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you take the voices away, I mean, actually, it would make a. And they, if they were just like saying the lines with that, it would make a brilliant film.
Have you kept the prologue talking of that?
I want to do it, yeah. I want to do it. We're just figuring out whether that's going to work out. But, I really like the prologue.
Joe, getting back to the the show that you're going to produce at the ENO. I noticed that you have done quite a lot of work with quite bare stages, as in the Figaro and the Lear just now in Germany. And you're going to be kind of forced to have quite a bare stage in this one because it's a semi-staging. They call it concert performance, which means the orchestra probably in the pit, but you have the big stage, but not a huge design budget. Is that a constraint? How's that going to affect your...
You know what? It's okay, actually, because you're kind of relieved from the burden of having to, like, present a whole castle and having to present some kind of literal epic set with staircases and seven doors, etc. You know, it necessarily just points you towards just focusing on the two performers. You know, and that's the thing that without a huge budget, it forces you to just focus on the two performers and the focus on the relationship between Bluebeard and Judith, you know. And on the one hand, you want to present the piece as this richly kind of mythical and metaphorical world with doors and castles. But on the one hand, you also want the audience to feel like, oh, this conversation that is happening between them is a conversation that is happening in bedrooms and kitchens all over London, you know, and all over the world every night, you know.
So much the worse for London, obviously.
Slightly off topic, there's something that interested me in the on the ENO website, is this, that they don't think it's a good opera for beginners. And what you just said there about that it can be relevant to anybody's relationship seems to me that it makes it an ideal opera for beginners, because it's short, quite apart from anything. The music's exciting, and it has this theme that, you know, someone with a little bit of discernment is going to be able to work out that it can be relevant to them. I don't think. I mean, what's your feeling about it as an opera for beginners?
I think it's quite good for beginners, like you say, exactly as you say, because it's short, and I think the music is incredibly accessible, actually, for the reasons you were saying, that it feels very much like incredible 20th century film scores. You know, it's not completely wacky and avant-garde, you know, it's the kind of beautiful lush strings, incredibly moving and evocative, but I mean, it's not one of the kind of knockabout fun operas, is it?
No,
it's not very jolly. So I think it's a great, if you have quite a pessimistic idea of love and intimacy and marriage, and I think it's a great one to start with. You know?
It's a lot shorter than Figaro.
That's right.
Yeah, and
that's
it doesn't have any of these irritating conventions. I mean, it just it starts, it does its seven doors, it finishes, and no interval. Before you know it, 8:30, you're back on the street.
Yeah, yeah.
In the pub, which is probably where we should all go now. I think that's been an absolutely marvellous chat. Thank you all
very
much.
It has been fantastic.
Leno, thank you very, very much for your musical jokes and things. And Joe, brilliant that you could come and talk about it. And we're very much looking forward to seeing Bluebeard, hearing and seeing Bluebeard again.
Yeah, great.
And more of your opera work, because after that Figaro, I want to see more of that as well.
Great,
Joshua
directs My Figaro Gets a Divorce.
And Len has written a sequel to
it. Oh, great.
Figaro Gets a Divorce, which was premiered at Welsh National Opera, but is available for further productions.
That's it.
And it's very good. Okay, that's it. Thank you so much. Paul.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.